It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new study shows that the American middle class is starting to decline compared to peers in other countries. We'll find out what that says about the American economy.
First, the apocalypse is a hot topic in society today. It seems to be everywhere, from movies like the upcoming version of Godzilla and the comedy This Is the End. But what would really happen if the world as we know it ended?
That's a question our next guest set out to answer in his new book. He wanted to create a blueprint for rebuilding a functional society. Lewis Dartnell joins us now. He's a UK Space Agency research fellow at the University of Leicester. He writes regularly for the New Scientist, The Times, and The New York Times, and he's the author of, The Knowledge, How to Rebuild Our World from Scratch. Lewis, welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
Well, you're a space research guy. Your area of expertise is astrobiology. What brought you down to Earth and to this topic of rebuilding our society?
I think it's just... So my main research, as you said, is in astrobiology and looking into the possibility, the real science, the search for life beyond Earth. I think it's one of those things that we've all thought about whether we're alone in the universe, about whether there might be something else out there or some kind of life on Mars. And I think the other question that every single one of us has thought about and, you know, maybe had a chat with our friends down and over in a cafe or in a bar or something late at night is, what would you do if civilization were to collapse? You know, who would be on your post-apocalyptic survival team? How many of us today have actually got any kind of practical skills to do things and make things for yourself? And I realize that I don't. I have no practical skills, nothing that would be of actual use. So I sat down to teach myself them and to try to work out, trying to think through how you could reboot a civilization right from scratch for this new book, For the Knowledge.
And if you study Earth's history, you know that there have been massive extinctions. There have been asteroids where, if there had been, you know, human civilization, then it would have been wiped out completely, or at least most of it. So is that where you started from, imagining, you know, some sort of natural disaster?
Absolutely. And as you say, kind of looking into outer space, there are a number of hazards, a number of genuine threats that have caused mass extinctions in the history of life on Earth. And have kind of affected, even during recorded history. There was a time in the year 1859, which is called the Carrington Event, because that was the name of an astronomer who noticed it. And it's one of the largest solar flares that's ever happened that we know about during human history. And this happened at a time when the world was still basically pre-electrical. There were some telegraph wires strung across the continent, but there wasn't power grids and kind of gadgets and electricity in use in the way that we would be familiar with today. And yet this solar flare, this coronal mass ejection, caused such a surge of electricity in these wires that it started wildfires, kind of in the middle of nowhere from the sparks from these telegraph wires. And if something like that were to happen today, it would crash, or would have the potential to crash, all of the power distribution grids, you know, across a hemisphere of the planet. We'd be knocked back in an instant to kind of a pre-electrical age. And it's this kind of cataclysm, this kind of event that might cause enough of a jolt to kind of collapse society, collapse civilization that I deal with in The Knowledge, along with other things like maybe a nuclear war, an asteroid strike, or maybe something like a pandemic flu, some kind of plague that wipes out people, as has happened in history with the bubonic death and the Black Death and bubonic plague.
And Lewis, you've set yourself a pretty tall order. Not only are you asking, how will I survive this, but how will we rebuild society? How will we preserve human knowledge?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's plenty of very good survival guides out there and prepper guides and things you can do as an individual to keep yourself alive and make sure you've got a stockpile of food and weapons and things you would clearly need once law and order and society have collapsed. You're going to have to look after yourself and protect yourself. And I didn't want to write that book again because there's plenty of good examples. But what I wasn't aware of, what I don't think had ever been written before, was what next? What do you do now? You've survived the apocalypse. You've got a community of survivors who have survived, and you're now trying to rebuild. You're trying to recover civilization and start providing things for yourself as a community. So the things I talk about in The Knowledge, that this book about how to rebuild our world from scratch, we look at different themes. We look at how you reboot agriculture from the ground up, literally from the ground up, how you make food for yourself so you don't starve to death. How do you make materials for yourself so you don't freeze to death? How do you work with metals or brick to be able to rebuild? But also, just importantly, it's not just kind of mechanisms and machinery that we rely upon in the modern world. It's all also about the kind of chemistry and the substances that we need, and how do you extract those from the natural world and process and refine them into things you need. So you can make something, you know, as simple as soap to stop yourself picking up transmissible diseases by the principles of hygiene and keeping your hands clean. I kind of look at all these different principles and processes to provide for yourself.
Well, let's dive into that a little bit. It seems as though agriculture would be pretty important. You've got to feed yourself to live. Mm. So what kind of knowledge do we need to know, base-level knowledge about a group of people feeding themselves?
Well, for starters, the very first chapter of the book talks about the grace period, about if you do wake up, you know, the morning after the night before, when kind of the world collapsed and the world, end of the world, as we know, happened last night, you don't have to literally the morning after walk out into a muddy field with a handful of seed and try to make food come out of it. You don't have to get right back to agriculture immediately, because clearly there'd be a lot of food left preserved in all the supermarkets and stores on the roads. So one of the calculations I worked out for the knowledge was, if you were to be locked in an average supermarket with all the kind of preserved food in there and enough water for you to drink, how long could you keep yourself going before that food ran out or went off and you started starving to death? And what I worked out is you could survive about 55 years in a single supermarket on the canned food before you'd eaten it all, and 63 years if you're prepared to eat all the cat food and dog food as well. And so when you multiply that up from not just one supermarket and yourself, but all of the supermarkets and distribution centers across the whole of the United States, and perhaps, you know, tens of thousands, if not 100,000 people surviving, there's still an enormous amount of preserved sustenance you can eat. And that gives you this buffer zone, this crucial grace period, where you get the opportunity to learn from your mistakes and, by a process of trial and error in agricultural fields, work out how to make food for yourself before it becomes a matter of life and death. But clearly things like the invention of the plow you'd want to be able to make for yourself, and understand that the process of cereal crops, which are supported throughout human history, you know, how they grow, what their life cycle is, how you harvest them, how you extract the grain, and then turn that into something you can actually eat, like bread. And one of the examples I talk about in the book is how the millstone, which is, you know, a cylindrical stone that you turn round and you grind the wheat grain between those two millstones, and you might use something like a water wheel or windmill to do that, like people have done throughout history.
What would your average broadcaster or astrobiologist need to know to make that millstone and hook it up to a water wheel?
I mean, there is a diagram in the book showing exactly how to do that. And then the principle behind it makes a lot of intuitive sense. You can have a wheel with some slats sticking out of it, and if you dunk that into the flow of water in a river, the wheel turns, and you use just a single gear called a right-angle gear, which I say is in the diagram in the book, in the knowledge. And that converts the kind of vertical turning to a horizontal turning, which is what you need for a millstone. And all you need for a millstone is, say, just a cylindrical stone, and you can chisel away at something to make that for yourself. And in this sense, that millstone, which has been used for thousands of years throughout the history of civilization, is essentially a technological extension of our molar teeth. It's something we've invented to enhance the way our bodies work and grind and crush up those cereal grains into flour that you then cook in bread, to save your own teeth from having to do all that work yourself. And there's plenty of examples through the history of civilization where you're inventing something or harnessing a natural power source, energy source, to do something that you could have done yourself, but you do it much, much more effectively or much more efficiently and easily. And that's basically the story of civilization, is how we've increased our capabilities over time.
We're talking to Lewis Dartnell. He's UK Space Agency Research Fellow at the University of Leicester. His new book is The Knowledge, How to Rebuild Our World from Scratch.
Yeah, and we'd love to hear from you on the topic. What do you think would be your most difficult thing to rebuild in the wake of an apocalypse? And do you have plans should the world as we know it end? What sort of knowledge are you worried about being lost? What needs to be carried through in the event of an apocalypse? Agriculture, maybe, or medicine? What sorts of things are you thinking about? Call in and share your ideas at 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. We're picking up our discussion with Lewis Dartnell, UK Space Agency Research Fellow at the University of Leicester, and the author of the book, The Knowledge, How to Rebuild Our World from Scratch.
And we want to hear from you on this topic. What would be the most difficult thing in our society to rebuild and the most necessary thing to rebuild in the wake of some kind of apocalypse? What skills would you bring to the table if you wanted to join a community of post-apocalyptic survivors? Or what skills do you wish you had? 800-642-1234 is the number. Call now at 800-642-1234 or send an email, talk@WPR.org.
And Lewis, one thing that a lot of people are thinking about is a survival kit. Now, if we move beyond stuff like Band-Aids and aspirin, but stuff that could really benefit civilization and the rebooting of civilization as a whole, what sorts of things should be in our survival toolkit? Things literally, I guess, like tools.
So clearly something like antibiotics would be immensely useful if you were preparing, if you're making arrangements for the end of the world, rather than just the starting point for the thought experiment for the knowledge is that you haven't prepared anything at all. You're just a normal person who wakes up to find civilization has disappeared and everyone's died, and you're trying to kind of start from scratch with a small community of survivors. But if you are able to preserve things ahead of time and kind of scavenge what you need, something like antibiotics would make an enormous difference to keeping you healthy in a kind of post-apocalyptic world, where things like disease will probably come back as the kind of scourge of humanity as it has been throughout history. And one of the things I talk about in the first chapter, during this grace period, where you've got things lying around in abandoned cities that you can scavenge and repurpose and use for yourself, is how you can use everyday objects in new ways, perhaps ways you haven't really thought of using before. And you can, for example, start fires with weird and wonderful combination of objects like a fire alarm or a bottle of water can be used to start a fire when you ironically would have thought that's the kind of thing you would use to warn yourself of fire or put one out. And there's a very surprising use, a medical use, you can put super glue to. And this was actually used during the Vietnam War for quickly patching up soldiers who were injured in the battlefield. And you can use super glue as a very, very effective way of closing a wound before it becomes infected, which you really, really want to be able to avoid in a post-apocalyptic world without access to, kind of healthcare and pharmaceuticals. And you just pull the lips of the wound together and then kind of apply super glue over the top to kind of seal those lips together and, I say, kind of close the wound. So there's a whole load of ideas of things that you can scavenge and repurpose to keep yourself going, whilst at the same time you're trying to learn and rediscover this, the human knowledge that might have been lost for how you do things for yourself and how you could rediscover the penicillin mold to make new antibiotics for yourself.
We'll bring our callers in on this now at 800-642-1234. We'll start with Carl in Madison. Carl, hi.
Yes, hello. I think this conversation is fun and interesting, but almost to me in a childlike way, like when you're a little kid and you say, I'm leaving, I'm going to pack my suitcase and go, and you're 7 years old as though you could possibly make it out there. I think that we as a society, we're an incredibly social animal, and we depend on the intricacies of our dependence on the natural world around us to sustain us. And if there were an apocalypse of any natural sort, that would just be the end of us. I think that what we have around us is the miracle of a world far more complex than we believe we can understand. And the reality that if we don't care for it and take care of it and address things like climate change, these kinds of conversations will be wonderful footnotes to the end of civilization. I don't think there's any way we can possibly invent our ways out of the interrelationship we have with this beautiful planet that we've got to take good care of.
Carl, thanks for the call. So a way to avoid the apocalypse, in part, he's saying there, but also saying a lack of knowledge of nature would hold us back now and in the post-apocalyptic setting.
I think Carl raises a very, very interesting point there, and climate change is clearly a very big hazard for all of us alive today, and certainly our children are going to be growing up in a world that will be certainly different from what we know. And I'm not downplaying these hazards and these risks, and they will, if this hypothetical situation does happen and civilization does collapse and you have to start trying to reboot from scratch, climate change will continue happening nonetheless, even if, you know, the Industrial Revolution has ended and polluting cars and factories disappear, climate change will continue because there's already enough inertia built into the Earth system, and the sea levels will rise. So it is definitely a concern. But the point behind the book, behind the knowledge, how to rebuild a world from scratch, I say it's kind of a thought experiment, and it's, you know, between you and me and all of your listeners, it's not really about the apocalypse at all. That's a conceit, that's a narrative sleight of hand for being able to hold up a mirror to our society, our civilization, and see how it works, and ask the question, what are the fundamental requirements for the running of a civilization? What does it require? What does it need? How do you provide for that? And if you needed to, in a hypothetical situation, how could you go right back to the basics and do it all for yourself, or at least as a community, from scratch to kind of recover it all? So it's about our world, our civilization, and our history of development and progression, and how you might accelerate that during a reboot the second time round.
Well, thank you a lot for the call, Carl. And we move next to Bob calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Bob.
Hi. The one point I would like to make out in a reset to the world, I would think the one thing that we would like to see would be textiles, the ability to make textiles with looms, hand techniques of extracting wool. I think it would be a very underestimated thing to just expect to use the fabrics that we have, because that stuff's just not going to last over time.
All right, good point. And I think that's something you would agree with, right, Lewis? A loom would be very handy.
Absolutely agree with Bob. He's bang on the money there. And there is a chapter about the techniques of spinning and weaving and building a loom. Because Bob's absolutely right that one of the things you really need to be able to provide for yourself is clothes, to kind of protect yourself from the elements and keep yourself warm and not die of exposure. And I talk about where you get fibers from. So the very basis of making clothes is extracting fibers from the natural world. And this might be things like cotton or silk or wool from kind of an animal source, and turning that into a thread by spinning it, and then turning that thread into fabric, into textiles by weaving it, and how you'd be able to achieve that for yourself.
And Lewis, one thing that's fundamental to basically the entire thought experiment of your book is the scientific method. This is something vital, you think, to passing along. Why?
Yeah, so the conceit for the book is that the knowledge contains all the information you would need to rebuild a civilization from scratch. But of course, that's a lie. No one book, and not even an entire library, could genuinely contain enough detail and information and kind of practical details to be able to do all this for yourself. So what I talk about in the book is that at the end of the day, what you need is a method for learning things for yourself, being able to work things out for yourself if a textbook isn't around anymore to tell you it. And this process of how you work out how the world works is a scientific method. It's a knowledge generation machinery that tells you which of the explanations you make up with your kind of imagination in your hypotheses is the one that's probably closest to the truth, and it's how you kind of accumulate knowledge over time. And it, you know, it's what we've been doing since the scientific revolution of the kind of 1500s, 1600s and on from there. And absolutely, you want to retain that same process and that same inquisitiveness of mind. You know, it's the kind of fire you would really want to keep burning brightly in a post-apocalyptic world to recover as quickly as you can.
Reading your book, I kept thinking of a Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court by Mark Twain. A 19th century tinkerer goes over to your neck of the woods, but in the mythical Arthurian world, and reinvents mining. He builds factories.
He invents gunpowder to
gunpowder, right.
Powerful wizard he is by blowing up Merlin's tower with his gunpowder that he knows the recipe for.
But he's a guy who's connected to how to make things in a way that most of us in the 21st century aren't. Are you hoping that, at least as part of the thought experiment, we try to be that kind of tinkerer again and make that kind of connection with how our world works?
That's exactly it. The one thing that I found a lot of enjoyment and fascination with when I was writing the knowledge, and what I hope people take away from having read the book, is just a deeper sense of appreciation and understanding of how things work in the world around us, and how this life support system of modern civilization provides for us and serves us. and creates and makes all these things that we used to know how to do ourselves, you know, 200 years ago, but none of us know anymore because civilization does it for us. I think that's a fascinating process to go through and just maybe have your eyes open a little bit more as to how these things work.
Lewis, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
We've been speaking with Lewis Dartnell, UK Space Agency Research Fellow at the University of Leicester. He's the author of the new book, The Knowledge, How to Rebuild Our World from Scratch.
You know, as a wannabe maker who never quite gets there, I always think about doing some of the things that might build some of these skills. I don't know, do you have any valuable skills that would help us in the post-apocalyptic world? Yeah.
I can bake stuff, and you're really good at bending paper clips.
That's true. So seek me out for all the post-apocalyptic paperclip bending needs.
It's Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we get our weekly dose of congressional news from Capitol Hill with USA Today's politics and Congress editor Paul Singer.
But first, new numbers show that the American middle class no longer holds the lead for overall prosperity compared to other middle-income earners around the world.
The data were collected over the course of 35 years in an international study. They suggest that American middle and low-income households are suffering from the effects of rising income inequality.
Arthur Delaney joins us to explain what's happening. He's a reporter for Huffington Post covering unemployment and economic issues. Arthur, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the American middle class has been the most affluent in the world compared to those of its peers. What's changed?
Well, part of it is really just that other countries are catching up. The United States has been way ahead, partly because for a long time the United States spent a lot more than other countries on public education for the past century. And so other countries, Canada, are now catching up, and we see that reflected in literacy and other skills that can be tested. But other parts of it are just that companies in the U.S. don't pay their workers as much, and our safety net is not as robust. So less money is being taxed from the rich and given to the middle class and the poor.
And contrast that to some of the countries who are catching up with us. What's happening there?
Well, you've got more robust social insurance programs that pay for things like retirement benefits and unemployment benefits that boost middle-class income. So when people lose their jobs here, you know, their income immediately shoots down, and you know, they can eventually be shunted out of the labor market altogether. In other countries, unemployment insurance lasts longer. The benefits are more generous. Other differences that I think are real interesting in other countries, workers get a lot more paid time off for vacation, time off for things like maternity and paternity leave. And the United States is really kind of backward in that respect.
Now, this is being viewed through the lens of income inequality that, for instance, the per capita gross domestic product is still doing pretty well, and yet the middle class and the lower class, the poor, aren't seeing it. Can you explain what's happening there?
Right. This is controversial and it's complicated, but essentially the idea is these other countries are able to catch up to the U.S. even though our per capita GDP growth is so strong, because instead of broadly distributing the growth in the form of higher wages for working people, rich people, CEOs and loafers who inherited a lot of money are siphoning up most of the growth, and we are taxing them at a lower rate than you see in other countries. And with less tax revenue, there's less of the money being redistributed. And that's one of the suggestions that the Times put forward in its analysis, and I think it's a pretty persuasive one.
Who's on top now?
Well, we're still on top in terms of the top percentile, but what they're highlighting is that Canada has caught up in the very middle and may have even surpassed the U.S., but the data go back only to 2010.
And one of the things that you touched on earlier was education, and that seems to be an area where other countries are catching up and younger Americans are declining in terms of the amount of education they're getting. Can you break that down for us?
Right. Well, people you know, are familiar with the idea that the United States historically has been a little stingy with its welfare state spending. But if you include education in that, over the past 100 years, we really were a leader. And that, I think, is explains a lot about why had so much more growth. And what's really happening is other countries are catching up, and we've got a lot of different things happening, particularly with higher education, fewer people reaping the benefits of post-secondary degrees.
Now, let's talk a little bit about the poor. We've been talking about the middle class. What happens when you look at people who are considered poor in America?
Well, they're doing even worse. I mean, we always focus on the middle class, and we lament the fact that Canada is going to take the top spot in that respect. But other countries had already surpassed us, according to this analysis, and that really reflects the low wages that people earn at low-skilled jobs. And a colleague of mine, Dave Jemison, did a great story this week about how the worker-to-CEO pay gap in the fast food industry is about 1,000%. That's the ratio of what CEOs make compared to their workers, 1,000% more. So we really don't reward low-skill work. And then the safety net benefits we do provide are a good deal stingier than what's available in some of these other countries.
Now, I want to go back and clarify something you said earlier. You said that the United States was on top. Now, you were referring there to the per capita GDP, right? But in terms of
right,
middle
and
class...
Also in the tippy top 95th percentile, our rich people are still the richest rich people.
But our middle class no longer.
Our middle class, it looks what they're saying is we're now tied with Canada, and Canada looking like it's likely to surpass us as they continue collecting this data. And then if you go further down the income scale to the 5th, 10th, and 20th percentiles, other countries have already done so. For instance, Norway and Germany.
Now, Europe has had an economic downturn in recent years, countries like Greece, for instance. How is that looking as compared to the United States?
Well, we're doing better than countries like Greece and other places where austerity really took hold. I mean, austerity starting in 2010, the policy of retrenching extra spending and cutting back on government deficit spending. But we didn't cut back as hard as some of these Western Europe countries. And so we're not doing as badly in that respect. But those countries are still suffering from the Great Recession.
Now, the United States has long had the most affluent middle class, going back more than a decade. I'm not sure how long it goes back, but how significant is it that this is no longer true?
It may have more psychological significance than real economic meaning. You know, we would prefer for USA to be number one at all times and all things. But, you know, it's not a zero-sum game. If some other country is doing well, that doesn't automatically subtract money from U.S. citizens or anything like that. But I'm sure everyone would prefer for the U.S. middle class to stay on top in these charts.
So psychologically taking a toll, but what about just as a bellwether of anything happening? Does it just represent a blip, or is it something that could be a continuing trend?
I think it's part of an ongoing trend that's reflected in all sorts of ways where, you know, middle class incomes are sort of stagnating right now. We haven't seen median middle class incomes go up at all in the U.S. in the past several years, while more and more money is going to the richest 0.1%. So it's a serious concern for policymakers looking at things like how do we fix our educational system, how should we change our tax code, et cetera.
Now, in terms of the things that trouble people, that keep people up at night when they're worried about money, they're worried about the economy, things like paying for college, do other countries, our peers in this scenario, do they share those same concerns?
I think people in most of these countries share a lot of the same concerns. The sense that you get from the Times story when they looked at poll data in all these different countries is that there's a little bit more gloom here among the middle class right now, more of a sense among people with middle-income jobs that things are just sort of flat, and they've been more affected by job loss, and they know more people have been badly affected by job loss than some of their middle-class peers in other countries.
Arthur, thanks a lot for coming on and talking with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've been talking to Arthur Delaney, a reporter for Huffington Post, explaining new numbers showing that American prosperity has dwindled for the middle class over the past three decades.
Now for our weekly behind-the-scenes look at Congress. Yesterday was Earth Day. How did Congress observe the occasion?
It's the second week of recess for Congress, and campaigns for fall elections are in full swing. Black voters played a key role in the 2008 and 2012 presidential elections, and some say they could be a deciding factor in which party takes the Senate this fall.
Also this election cycle, female candidates are taking a front seat in some hotly contested races. Here with us to talk about these issues, we've got politics editor at USA Today, Paul Singer. He joins us every Wednesday at this time. Welcome back, Paul.
Thanks, Rob. How you doing?
Real good. How are you doing today?
So far, so good.
All right. Well, this week was Earth Day, and we've seen some reporting on different attitudes toward Earth Day from the two parties. A report in the National Journal said, as far as they could tell, a Republican hasn't said the name of the holiday in Congress since 2010. Why this stark distinction between the two parties?
Well, you know, part of that is the general polarization of Congress, where if you are in favor of the environment and environmental regulation, particularly, you stay out of the Republican Party, or vice versa. That is, Republicans in general are very skeptical of environmental regulation, or at least Republicans in this Congress are very skeptical of environmental regulation, and it's just not a topic that is important to them to celebrate. The celebration of Earth Day is increasingly a Democratic and pretty much Democratic-only event.
Did Democrats do anything with that in Congress? I know they're out of session. There are committees going on. Were they talking Earth Day this time around?
No, I mean, they're out of session, and they're all back in their districts. They've been off for 2 weeks, and, you know, they all had events, and a bunch of them were on Twitter, you know, celebrating, yay, let's go do something for the environment. But, you know, it's a pretty pretty low-key affair. At this point, I think Earth Day, mostly it's the anniversary years that people, you know, make a bigger deal of. But there was, you could have, if you were in Washington on Earth Day, you would not have known you're in Washington on Earth Day. There was nothing really bringing attention to it here.
When candidates of either party are out giving their stump speeches in an election year, is the environment, issues of environmental regulation, pro or con, usually early in the speeches, or is it off the agenda completely?
That's more of a local issue than a national issue. So if you are in a place like Kentucky, the so-called war on coal being waged by EPA and the Obama administration is the first subject that a Republican candidate will bring up. Likewise, obviously, if you are in places like California along the coast, if you're someplace in Louisiana and a Democrat is running, you will hear a lot about the need to address climate change because you're afraid of flooding and et cetera. But that's really a much more a local issue than a national issue. This is not something that resonates nationally at this point, in part because the environmental challenges most people face are local issues, like should you put a landfill in my backyard?
And those are the kind of issues that resonate more with voters than the big picture stuff?
Yeah, like climate change, or the big picture climate change, it's just really hard to get people's brains around it. It's really hard to figure out what can I do that is a climate change action or action to combat climate change, and it just doesn't. We don't see it appearing high on the minds of voters on a national scale.
Well, speaking of how the parties talk to voters, some analysis here saying that black voters and how much they show up the polls will play a big role in key Senate races this year. Do you think that's a fair characterization of what's going on?
Yeah. Now, you have to be careful about these kind of things because, you know, we do this every election year, and I, you know, am here confessing my own guilt. You know, every election year we do stories about, ooh, women voters are going to be really important. Ooh, black voters are going to be really important. Hey, Hispanic voters are important. Wow. Don't forget the Asian voters. You know, because when you're talking about a couple of points in the ballots making a difference, then, of course, all these groups make a difference. Mm-hmm. There are particular races where I think black voters are going to be a big deal, particularly like if you look at like a Louisiana, where it's a very close race. We talked about, I think, last week, you know, Mary Landrieu is running for re-election. Is a very heavily Democratic, very heavily black Democratic voter base there. If the Democrats are going to win in Louisiana, they're going to need black voters to get out and vote. And in general, in midterm elections, non-presidential elections, the black vote is much lower. So you will see, I think, efforts from the Democrats particularly to try and get black voters to the polls in some of those key states. Will they be decisive? Maybe, but I think the real issue still is, are you going to get middle-class white voters? That's where the bulk of the voters are, and those are the people you have to get to win an election.
You mentioned what Democrats are doing. What are Republicans doing with that in mind?
Well, you know, we wrote an interesting story about a week or so ago about Republican outreach to black voters. And what was interesting about it is that the Republicans said, essentially, we are starting at the ground level. We are trying to build databases and identify people and reach out, maybe not for this year, maybe it'll be 2 years from now that it really starts to pay off, and maybe even further down the road. I mean, I think they recognize at this point that certainly in the presidential election, I think Obama got something like 96% of the black vote or something. I mean, they just the Republican Party is largely not a player amongst black voters on a national basis. And I don't think they think that's going to change soon. They are trying to implement some strategies to change it eventually.
It seems like one of the big differences, regardless which voter group you talk about, is presidential year versus by-election year. You had a very sophisticated get-out-the-vote campaign from the Obama campaign a couple years back. I may have made a difference here in Wisconsin's Senate race. Now you've got Senate races without that in play. How critical a difference is that?
Well, in fact, the Democratic Party and the Republican Party both, but particularly the Democratic Party, are very heavily trying to keep that network alive through the off years. Part of the idea, Obama had this Obama for America organization that was this large grassroots thing. That has now been spun off into its own organization called Organizing for America, and that group is basically trying to keep a grassroots activity effort ongoing into the midterm elections. And I think part of the theory here is to see if they can prevent that kind of drop-off in the midterms. I mean, I don't think they can, for the simple reason that people just, you know, you think of Election Day, you think of the presidency, and it matters to you a lot. If it's a Senate race, maybe you're not sure how much it matters. If it's particularly if it's a governor's race, you're not sure how it matters. If there isn't a competitive race in your state or in your district, you may not care that much. People just don't go as much in the off years. That's all there is to it.
Well, turning to the candidates this year in the Senate race, you've seen a trend in female candidates taking a front seat in some of those key races we've been talking about. Who are we paying attention to?
Well, and this is interesting. I think, you know, some of the major battles are going to be for re-election of women. They're going to be Kay Hagan in North Carolina, Jean Shaheen in New Hampshire, again Landrieu, like we said, in Louisiana. In Kentucky, the race against Mitch McConnell, the Senate Republican leader, is a Democrat named Allison Lundergan Grimes. In Georgia, the Democratic candidate is Sam Nunn's daughter, Michelle Nunn. Some of your listeners, I'm sure, remember Senator Nunn. So some of the, the swing seats, the key seats, the seats that may determine the outcome of the balance of power in the Senate are women, particularly the Democratic women. They're going to need those Democratic women to deliver. It'll be an interesting thing that if the Democrats manage to keep control of the Senate, it will be because of the women.
Is this uncommon to see this many women? There's been a decades-long conversation. Why aren't there more women in politics, especially at something like the Senate level?
It's been growing over the years. You know, I think, I'm going to mess this number up. I probably
That's
should
fine.
Have gotten a look. But there's like 14 women in the Senate now, which is a historically high number. And by the way, some of those women have been very critical decision makers in some of the discussions over the, for instance, the government shutdown. It was Patty Murray from Washington, the senator who was really negotiating out that deal and the budget deal. She is now the budget chairwoman. Women are a much more central force in Washington than they were probably two decades ago. And I think increasingly so. Needless to say, if you get a woman presidential candidate, no names necessary, that sort of highlights that fact.
Well, one name that's been thrown out with a new book out there, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren. Some Democrats on the left are hoping she'll raise a challenge to, say, Hillary Clinton running more in the middle. Do you think the book is a sign that a senator, an early-term senator, is maybe thinking about a presidential run?
Yeah, you know, I think every senator is thinking about a presidential run in some little corner of their mind. You know, they think, well, I could be president of the United States. I wouldn't hold your breath on Elizabeth Warren. I mean, I don't imagine she would challenge Hillary Clinton if Hillary Clinton gets into the race. Even if she doesn't get into the race, I'm not convinced that Elizabeth Warren has kind of broad name recognition, the networks she needs. She's also, you know, comes from the liberal side of the Democratic Party. That may not be the most successful way to run for office in America in 2016. I don't know. I mean, I believe all of them think they could be president, which is the funny thing about the Senate. But I think very few of them actually end up making the run for it because it's hard, it's expensive, it's a terrible way to live your life, and most of them lose.
All right. Well, again, we'll be picking these issues up in weeks to come. Paul, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks, Rob. Senate's back next week, so we'll have more to talk about.
All right. That was USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. He joins us each Wednesday at this time. We talk congressional and election politics. We'll talk to him again next week.